is Mark Riley, and I want to thank you for tuning in to this podcast. You know, there's a lot of crazy things going on in the world, back and forth, this and that, name-calling, the possibility of another government shutdown. But I want to start out this particular episode by asking, what are we to make of Jeff Bezos? The founder of Amazon, owner of the Washington Post, and a man who most Americans think has more money than God. He dominated the latter half of this week's news cycle, and as they say in the journalism business, this story appears to have legs. His charge that the publisher of the National Enquirer tried to blackmail and extort him led to a headline that will be studied by journalism school students for years to come. Comes from the New York Post, where else? Bezos exposes Pecker, talking about the publisher of the National Enquirer. It's fascinating on several levels, this whole thing. First, Bezos has transformed, or has been transformed, from just another greedy capitalist to some sort of hero or anti-hero for standing up to the evil Enquirer. Think about that for a minute. A guy who is in charge of Amazon, who many feel has taken online retailing to a whole different level and put a lot of small businesses out of business, is now a hero. I have, however, a couple of questions about this. One, why are so many Americans concerned with the lives of billionaires? I mean, we have a president who says he's a billionaire, and maybe that's part of the reason why. Jeff Bezos is definitely a billionaire, so maybe that's part of the reason why. But it seems as though ordinary Americans are consumed with the lives of billionaires. Now, Jeff Bezos has perhaps adequate reason for Americans to look at him and scrutinize him relatively closely. One, he's divorcing his wife of 25 years. Two, he's apparently seeing now a woman who was a former anchor for Fox News in L.A., or the Fox News station, I should say, in L.A. Maybe that's enough. After all, we have the guy who was the former CEO of Starbucks, another billionaire, who at least fascinated people for about a week or so as he talked about an independent run for president. But Bezos is probably going to have to kick out a lot of money to satisfy whatever divorce demands his wife makes. So it leads to the question, are billionaires so much better off than ordinary people in the real world, in the light of day? But then, and this is really kind of like bugging me out, there are pictures or whatever the Enquirer has and was prepared to use to blackmail him. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, billionaires take selfies? Really? Naked, semi-naked photos exchanged with your mistress? Really? Actually, sounds kind of regular to me, I guess. I mean, I am one of those who has never taken a selfie. My daughter has, but I've never taken one. Maybe that part of life has completely passed me by. But why a man like Jeff Bezos would feel the need to take selfies of his private parts to send to his girlfriend is utterly beyond me. Utterly beyond me. See, because now you've got the National Enquirer contacting you saying, somebody gave us these pictures, and if you don't watch your step, we'll publish them. Well, you got to ask yourself, why would you put yourself in that kind of position? All of us, and I would emphasize this, all of us have parts of our lives that maybe we don't want other people to see, other people to know about. But in a previous episode, I questioned whether or not there may be something different that we're evolving to in this, beginning of the end of the early aughts or the mid-aughts or the late aughts or whatever this is in the 21st century, maybe we're entering a new epoch here where selfies, taking pictures of your private parts, sending them to people, putting them online, maybe that's all going to be the new normal. I hope not. But it appears as if, at least for Jeff Bezos and people like him, it is a new normal. Yet, beyond the superficial nature of the feud between AMI, American Media, and Jeff Bezos, and whether any of it had to do with Saudis, because they've been brought into this equation in terms of some of the accusations that have gone on, there is a question. Why does it look as though, and this is relatively local because I live near New York City, but why does it look like nobody gives a second thought to the fact that Jeff Bezos' company, Amazon, purports to come to New York City, a union town, and then goes in front of a city council committee and says, no, we're not having any unions. We're going to be fighting unions. I don't understand that. It like boggles the mind. Worse yet, Amazon, who are the proposed recipients of $3 billion, with a B, dollars worth of city largesse, made deals already with two unions before a spade of dirt was moved to build their new facility. I find that utterly incomprehensible. If you had said, if Amazon, not you, if Amazon had said, okay, we may not agree with everything unions do, but we'll negotiate with good faith. No, yeah, at least that part of the anti-Amazon table might have lacked a leg. But instead, they come here, they make deals with two unions, and then say, we don't want any more. We don't want, and if you look at it from one perspective, they may well be saying, we don't want our lower wage employees to be unionized. See, because the people that they made the deals with are the people that are going to build the facility. They're not low wage employees. Some of the other union involved, not a low wage representative of unions. There's a problem here. A serious problem here with what Amazon is coming to New York and saying. And of course, part of the problem too is that there were people who perhaps should have been part of the deliberative process to bring Amazon here and offer incentives who were completely left out of the equation. Amazon was presented to New York as a fait accompli. This is where we're having it. It's going to be in Long Island City. It's going to create 25,000 new jobs. It's going to have an average salary of $150,000 a year, which is difficult enough for New Yorkers to wrap their brains around. And it's all will be wonderful. And yes, it's worth the $3 billion in incentives that we're giving Amazon to come and locate here. Now, to be fair, Amazon had a choice of many cities. By the way, many of whom, since this controversy began, have said, hey, you know, you don't have to come to New York. You can come to Boston, come to Dallas, come to this place, come to that place. There's a reason why New York won out. And I can get into a great deal of detail about why that is. But the bottom line here is, why is Jeff Bezos, while dealing with all of this other stuff, he seems to have a very hands-off approach to dealing with the city of New York. I mentioned earlier, it is part of the problem here is a deliberative process that did not happen, that should have happened. The mayor and the governor were both on the same page about this, ironically enough, even though they feud about almost everything else. But others who should have been part of the process are not, and we're not part of the process. Now, the difficulty there is that despite the fact that everyone thought that there was no way this process could be changed, altered, or God forbid, scuttled, it appears that's not the whole truth either. But Amazon is saying earlier toward the end of the week that they would reconsider locating in New York City. Then there were reports that came out at the end of the week that said Amazon has not reconsidered locating in New York City, that this is going to happen one way or the other. I just find it interesting that Jeff Bezos, who's maybe he's busy, maybe he's caught up in all this other stuff he's involved with, but he has not put his imprint on this Amazon to New York City move. And this may have been the one case where he should have. Maybe he needed to get involved here. Maybe he needed to sit down with people because people held anti-Amazon demonstrations as recently as the other day. There is a deep pocket of New Yorkers who are not happy with this. Now, there is a question here about who will get those 25,000 jobs. And this is a very real question, and from my vantage point, a legitimate one. Amazon is purporting to locate not far from the Queensbridge houses. Now, the Queensbridge houses is a gigantic public housing development. It has 6,000 residents. That's a lot of people. Many of those folks are poor people, working poor people, people who are struggling. And they're going to build this huge spot without seemingly any consideration as to whether or not those residents of the Queensbridge houses, and Queensbridge houses, if you know anything about hip hop, and I know a little, Queensbridge houses were generally credited with being the birthplace of hip hop. Now, I know there are people in the Bronx who would argue about this, but the bottom line is a lot of very famous people, including several that I know personally, came out of the Queensbridge houses. And at some point, you got to ask yourself, what kind of promises should the city of New York and the state of New York, what kind of promises should they have gotten about employment for these folks, these 6,000 residents? And not all of them are going to be employable, obviously. Some of them are retired. Some of them are already in jobs they like, whatever. But what are you doing to perhaps train young people in the Queensbridge houses for the jobs at Amazon? And there seems to have been no promise about that whatsoever. Again, maybe Jeff Bezos is just too busy to pay attention to these sorts of things. Maybe his divorce from his wife, maybe the selfies he took of his private parts, maybe that's all too consuming for both him, the people around him, because he's got one guy who's supposedly investigating the source of the leak that got those pictures and selfies or whatever to the National Enquirer. Now, having been in the journalism business, I don't have a great deal of respect for the National Enquirer. I didn't before I realized that its chief executive, David Pecker, is a good friend of Donald Trump's. That's their business, as far as I'm concerned. But the National Enquirer, seeming from where I sit, seems to have made its reputation and made its money just purveying junk, okay? But it appears now, and this is due to several things that took place a while ago, where there were allegations in the National Enquirer that turned out to be true, there is now a sheen of legitimacy behind the National Enquirer. And certainly, if it's true that Jeff Bezos was extorted or there was a blackmail attempt made by the National Enquirer, then you're talking about a very, very serious allegation. People are going back and forth about whether or not it's criminal. I don't know. I don't care. The bottom line is, if they did it, they really don't deserve to be in business. But it's not certainly my place to put them out of business. Long as you've got supermarkets with little areas where they put tabloid magazines, there'll still be a National Enquirer. And some of the ones that have populated those spaces, some might argue, are a lot worse than the National Enquirer. So we'll see how this all plays out. We'll see if Jeff Bezos manages to squash all this by the middle of next week or whether it will continue to be an issue. And we'll see what happens with New York City versus Amazon. And maybe I shouldn't call it that, because there are some New Yorkers that are in favor of it, but it doesn't look like a majority of New Yorkers are in favor of it in terms of the voice of the people that are that are opposing it. When we come back, what exactly is socialism? This is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. Thank you for tuning in. For updates, like my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Send me an email at mark@markrileymedia.com. We will be back very, very shortly. So what exactly is socialism? And I'll explain my reasons for asking this question in a moment. According to Wikipedia, socialism is a range of economic and social systems characterized by social ownership and workers' self-management of the means of production, as well as the political theories and movements associated with them. Social ownership can be public, collective, or cooperative ownership, or citizen ownership of equity. Now, that doesn't sound real scary, does it? I mean, there are probably other definitions of what socialism is, but that one doesn't scare me in particular. Maybe it scares you just a bit. So my question is, why is everybody so afraid of the term socialism? The president, during his State of the Union address, said that the United States will never become a socialist country. Never become a socialist country. Well, for a guy that touts himself as being a billionaire, I could see why he would say that. But to date, there's one congressperson and one senator who have identified themselves as socialists. That would be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders, one in the Senate, one in the House. They jump up and say, yeah, I'm a socialist, and they managed to get themselves elected to public office. So why would the president of the United States, based on the fact that two people in the Congress say they're socialists, make a point of saying in his State of the Union address that socialism will never be the practice of the United States of America? Could it be, and I'm just speculating here, but could it be that he is seeing some movement among the electorate toward at least some policies that he would consider to be socialist? Not me, but he would consider to be socialist. Is the president frightened of these two folks, Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? Or is it really that people are seeming to be more receptive to their ideas, or at least giving their ideas a fair hearing? Maybe history has something to do with America's knee-jerk, in many cases, reaction to socialism, because make no mistake about this. Donald Trump didn't just drop the term socialist in his State of the Union for laughs or for effect. Well, yeah, for effect, because he knows his base and numbers of other people who may not even be part of his base recoil at the word socialism, recoil at politicians who call themselves socialists. Donald Trump didn't do this by accident. He was using what those in journalism call a dog whistle. Now, part of this has to do with the history of the country and the history of the world. During World War II, both the USSR and the Nazis had the term socialist in their nomenclature. It was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. The Nazis were the National Socialist German Party. So you see that socialism was in both of their nomenclatures. The question then becomes, why did people have a problem with both? And I think the reasons are obvious. Both were totalitarian states who twisted, in my judgment, the term socialist to benefit a relatively small group of people at the top of the economic, political, social totem pole. Whether it was Stalin or Hitler, those folks didn't miss any meals. The German people, the Soviet people, lost a great deal during the Second World War. I mean, when you start talking about 2 million Soviet troops killed just to defend one city, you're talking about a humongous cost. And of course, any system, in my judgment, that ignores that cost does so at its peril further down the road. But the president certainly is using the term socialist. And keep in mind that years ago, Go back four decades. It wasn't socialism. It was communism during the 1950s. The House Un-American Activities Commission looked into various people's affiliation with communism, their outlook on it, whether they belonged to the Communist Party. I know because I had family that was jailed for refusing to testify before the House Un-American Activities Commission. So we're talking about a fear back then of communism. And I'm not sure most Americans know the difference, and I'm not even sure I know the difference between communism and socialism. But maybe that's where the seed was planted in terms of how Americans look at what is essentially a very different system than the one we have. We have a capitalist system. During the Great Depression, however, there was nervousness on a part of a lot of people, including, by the way, people who were part of the moneyed interests of the time, that Americans would start to look at socialism, communism, whatever, as a viable alternative to starving in the streets, which many were during that period, during the late 20s, early 30s. So now, fast forward to 2019, and go back to the question of why Donald Trump would use the term socialist to say America will never be a socialist country. There's no objective evidence to say that America is turning into a socialist country unless you believe that programs like Medicare for All, programs like the Green New Deal, in fact, represent socialism or creeping socialism, socialism that is somehow becoming attractive to the American people and has a chance of becoming implemented. Any progressive idea, as far as this president and his supporters are concerned, any progressive idea that threatens to empower more people is socialist. And that's just my opinion. You know, you can agree to disagree. Feel free to disagree. To me, that means the less information about ideas and the more demonization based on dog whistles, that suits Trump, that suits his supporters just fine. Now we've got Elizabeth Warren entering the presidential sweepstakes. And the best thing that Donald Trump can come up with out of his mouth, and he didn't start when Elizabeth Warren announced, but to call her Pocahontas and then make all kinds of aspersions about the Trail of Tears. And of course, it belies an inherent racism against the first peoples of this country, that he would do that. And I'm not here to argue whether or not Elizabeth Warren is one quarter of 1% indigenous or not. It doesn't make any difference to me. I'm looking at her policies. And my fervent hope is that Americans will remember how Donald Trump is attempting to demonize anybody that has a progressive thought or idea. Why is he doing so? Because the people that he represents want to take America back to a different time. Somehow, they've been told and sold on the idea that America, when things were a little bit different, when blacks were segregated, when Native people were demonized on television, that was a period that America needs to go back to, where everybody knew their place, everybody knew their function. And Donald Trump has been able to say to people, well, wait a minute, look at the low unemployment rate. And we do, in fact, have a low unemployment rate. Look at the jobs numbers. Thousands of jobs, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of jobs each month in this country. And, you know, I'm not going to quarrel and quibble with those statistics because I didn't do it when Barack Obama was president. I do believe in balance on that level. But let's talk about what kind of jobs are being created. Let's talk about people still having to struggle to make ends meet, still living paycheck to paycheck, still having to worry, for example, about the possibility of another government shutdown, you know, in the very near future. And what that did to people who didn't get reimbursed during that time, because there are quite a few. 800,000 people were cast out of work or were cast out of work or brought in to work for free until they straightened everything out. And still, we don't have much. Still, we don't have the framework for an agreement. But that's for greater minds than mine to contemplate. All I know is that the socialist solutions that Donald Trump appears to be so afraid of might empower numbers of people who are not now empowered. See, my thing is very simple. When you look at how a leader governs a country, you don't just ask yourself about the unemployment rate or new jobs created, et cetera. I ask, how many people during that person's term as president, prime minister, whatever, how many people have been moved out of poverty during that period? 4 years, all right, how many people have been moved out of poverty in 4 years? And there are not that many people, certainly not in America, who can claim large numbers of people. We can say, for example, that the Affordable Care Act created a situation for more and more people to be insured. That we can say. But we cannot say that X number of people have been moved out of poverty. And we don't even measure. We don't even measure politicians based on that, on policies and programs that move people into perhaps a bit of comfort in their lives. You know, if you're here in New York, maybe you can go to City Island on the weekend or something. We don't measure people like that. And if that makes me a socialist, so be it. I got no problems with it. Because I believe my station in life is tied to everyone else's station in life. Maybe that does make me a socialist. Sorry. I have seen the wages of greed in this country over a long period of time. I remember when a movie said greed is good and people believed that crap. It is not good. But the more people who can move out of poverty, out of being poor, out of scuffling on a day-to-day basis for life, that's the system that I agree with. And it may not be that socialism will have a foothold in this country during my lifetime. That's entirely possible. Because Americans, as I said before, are knee-jerk scared of the term socialism. And maybe with good reason, given the way it's been twisted and perverted throughout history. But I'm going to tell you something. If you take the Wikipedia definition, socialism is a range of economic and social systems characterized by social ownership and worker self-management of the means of production, as well as the political theories and movements associated with them. Social ownership can be public, collective, or cooperative ownership, or citizen ownership of equity. I don't see anything all that wrong with that. I don't understand why people would have such a serious problem with that. But hey, it's just me. And I'm just asking.
There stands the glass that will ease all my pain.
Our final segment of this episode is going to deal with something that I never thought I would see. And it has to do with a man, his wife, and his girlfriend, all of whom are living together. Thanks so much for joining us. I'd love to hear from you at my Facebook page, Mark Riley Media. Whether you agree with me or disagree, let's have the conversation. Back in a flash.
Brother, I'm on my way.
Join the conversation at Mark Riley Media on Facebook.
I'm wondering if you are all right.
This is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley, and thank you so much for staying with us. Our final story this episode has to do with a few people, a relatively small number of people, who have apparently captured some public recognition in a relatively short period of time. The people I'm talking about are B. Smith, her husband, Dan Gasby, and Alex Lerner. Is it a love triangle? Is it an outrage? Is it neither? Or is it both? For those who don't know what I'm talking about, model and restaurateur B. Smith has Alzheimer's disease. According to her husband, Dan Gasby, she has the cognition of a child. In the meantime, Dan Gasby has moved his girlfriend, Alex Lerner, into the home he shares with his wife. Now, a lot of this would be on the down low under normal circumstances, but it has come to public attention because Dan Gasby apparently, for reasons best known only to himself, has decided to make videos of this little triangle that he has with his wife, B. Smith, and his girlfriend, Alex Lerner. The whole scenario has caused an uproar, and Dan Gasby has tried to portray the three of them as one happy family. Now, a cascade of questions would seem to follow this scenario, implausible though the scenario on its face may seem. Now, I guess for people who don't know her or don't know of her and her reputation, at one point, Barbara Smith was the epitome of African-Americans' female sophistication. She was a model. She had restaurants in New York and D.C. and elsewhere, and one in particular out in the Hamptons. She had a beautiful place out in the Hamptons. She seemed to be living this extraordinarily charmed life. People called her the Black Martha Stewart. She was, for many, the arbiter of style, class, and sophistication in Black America. And it was a shame, and I think a lot of people were certainly saddened to hear that she had gotten sick and that she, in fact, had Alzheimer's. But why move a woman, any woman, into your home when you share it with your spouse? I don't care what your spouse's condition. Why would you do that? It seems to me that there's a modicum of, how best to put this, egocentrism, perhaps, in that. That you're putting your own physical needs above the needs of your spouse. Be that as it may, let's move to the second question in this little cascade. And that would be, why would you go public about all this? Why would this be something that you decided to do in the first place? But once you decided to do it, why did you want everybody to know about it? Dan Gasby appeared on The View, for Christ's sake. What in the world for? To portray himself as somebody who is somehow noble? Yes, he's caring for his wife, but he's having his girlfriend care for his wife at the same time. He is trying to promote the idea that his mistress is his wife's caregiver. And beyond that, how do you manage to get yourself making out with this woman, Alex Lerner, in camera range? It was a private party, apparently, and somebody had one of those, you know, phone cameras. But apparently a gossip columnist went on television and showed this video, this clip of Dan Gasby making out with Alex Lerner while he is still, last I checked, married to his wife. How can Dan Gasby really know what his wife, B. Smith, feels living with a disease like Alzheimer's? I don't think anybody who doesn't have it really understands what it's like. You can certainly say that people can understand what it's like to care for somebody in that situation. But imagine yourself being in B. Smith's situation and doing the same thing. Imagine if the situation was reversed and it was Dan Gasby, God forbid, who had Alzheimer's, and B. Smith decided to move a boyfriend in with them. I don't think most people can even imagine that. There's something about this that is at the same time tacky and exploitative. To have a gossip columnist, for God's sake, go on television and show video footage of a guy making out with his girlfriend while he's still married. And, you know, there was the few parts that I've seen of Dan Gasby, or the few clips I've seen of Dan Gasby, he is like so extraordinarily defiant about this that I'm not doing anything wrong, that there's really not a problem in any of this. And I'm saying to myself, like, what color is the sky in your world, man? Did you, you know, if you had, for example, said, okay, because I know they have the money, you get a full-time caregiver for your wife, and then you have, as tacky as it may be, a girlfriend who you visit at her apartment periodically, that's one thing. And I'm not saying that's right either. You know, not that I'm the moral arbiter of what time of day it is, but I don't understand this. I don't understand it. And what makes it more difficult for me to contemplate is that Dan Gasby ain't no kid. Dan Gasby's my age, and he's engaging in this kind of conduct. I cannot imagine a scenario under which I would do this. Now, he has argued forcefully, in fact, that his wife really doesn't understand what he's doing, and that Alex Lerner, his mistress, is considered by Barbara Smith to be his, her friend. His friend and her friend. And there was some footage of Alex Lerner getting physical with Barbara Smith. It would never have gotten that far as I'm concerned. Never gotten that far. It does not make logical sense to me. Now, you know, I'm not perfect. And certainly Dan Gasby and Alex Lerner have their own reasons for maintaining this construct and publicizing this construct. You know, in a lot of cases, something like this would happen and people would say, no, I don't even want anybody to know about this. Sort of like Jeff Bezos and the selfies he took. It's like, I don't want anybody to know about this. But yet, maybe it's because Barbara Smith had a very, very wide circle of friends and admirers. And if those friends and admirers had gotten wind of this and it had become public, maybe Dan Gasby just thought he'd be ahead of the curve and publicize it himself so he wouldn't have to worry about other people publicizing it for him. Either way, it doesn't make logical sense. I sincerely hope that B. Smith is able to live the rest of her life in peace and harmony, living with Alzheimer's. Not an easy thing, but hopefully she will be able to live her life in comfort and, you know, to the extent that she has worked throughout her life to get to a point. It would be nice if she had a husband who had a sincere concern for her well-being. And I'm not saying that Dan Gasby doesn't have a concern for her well-being, but I question whether that concern is best manifested by having a mistress live at home with you and your wife. You and your wife who is sick, ill. Why not just get a caregiver? Don't make your girlfriend your wife's caregiver. It just simply is beyond belief for me. And the saddest part of it all is that it has become an ongoing story. I mean, the guy went on The View, got castigated there by a few people, and then turned around and had a situation where a gossip columnist, who, by the way, has a podcast just like me, gets on a TV show, I think it was a local TV show, and says, yeah, well, here's a video clip of Dan Gasby making out with Alex Lerner. And I didn't realize, you know, essentially turning it into scandal sheet stuff. And at the same time, oh, yeah, and this is my podcast. Hey, different strokes for different folks. Maybe he's got 5 million followers. I got 3. It doesn't matter to me. It's just like, it's unseemly. I guess that's the best way to put it. Unseemly. Not something that ought be discussed, bandied about, tossed about. It just doesn't, for me, make sense. Now, maybe I'm old-fashioned. God forbid. You know, when I was a kid, the last thing in the world I wanted to be called was old-fashioned. That was something for my parents. You know, my parents were old-fashioned people. You know, spare the rod, spoil the child. You know, that kind of old-fashioned. The old-fashioned kind of parent that said you'll eat what's on your plate or else. That kind of old-fashioned. And I guess it sort of troubles me and befuddles me at this point in my life that maybe there are certain things that have just utterly and completely passed me by and that I can't really wrap my brain around. But I cannot, and maybe I won't, wrap my brain around the conduct of these two people with regard to Barbara Smith. It just doesn't make sense. It's not congruent. It's tacky. It's exploitative. It's about choices and not good choices. I mean, come on, folks. And, you know, maybe this is the only instance of this taking place on planet Earth. Let's hope so. And let's hope that this is the last time we have to see or hear about it in public. That's all I ask. Old-fashioned me, Mr. I don't take selfies. My daughter does, but I don't. Mr., you know, living in a different time. Mr., why should I care about X, Y, Z? I understand. I really, really do. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The executive producer of The Intersection is Ms. Kim Jack Riley. Again, for updates, like my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. You can send me an email at mark@markrileymedia.com. If you have a topic you want me to cover, email me, mark@markrileymedia.com. Or if you're thinking about taking an action with regard to next year's presidential elections, email me, mark@markrileymedia.com. Whether you agree with me or disagree with me, let's have that conversation. Post your comments on my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Till we meet again, be well.
Here's your invitation to the baddest duke in town.